That night was full of talk and meetings and preparations for the morrow, and the next morning the convention turned upon Robespierre. One Tallien threatened him with a dagger. When he tried to speak, he was shouted down, and the president jingled the bell at him. "President of assassins," cried Robespierre, "I demand speech." It was refused him. His voice deserted him. He coughed and spluttered. "The blood of Danton chokes him," cried someone. He was accused and arrested there and then with his chief supporters. Whereupon the Hotel de Ville, still stoutly Jacobin, rose against the convention, and Robespierre and his companions were snatched out of the hands of their captives. There was a night of gathering, marching, counter-marching, and at last, about 3 in the morning, the forces of the convention faced the forces of the Commune outside the Hotel de Ville. Henriot, the Jacobin commander, after a busy day, was drunk upstairs. A parley ensued, and then, after some indecision, the soldiers of the Commune went over to the government. There was a shouting of patriotic sentiments, and someone looked out from the Hotel de Ville. Robespierre and his last companions found themselves betrayed and trapped. 2 or 3 of these men threw themselves out of a window and injured themselves frightfully on the railings below without killing themselves. Others attempted suicide. Robespierre, it seems, was shot in the lower jaw by a gendarme. He was found, his eyes staring from a pale face whose lower part was blood. Followed 17 hours of agony before his end. He spoke never a word during that time, his jaw being bound up roughly in dirty linen. He and his companions, and the broken, dying bodies of those who had jumped from the windows, 22 men altogether, were taken to the guillotine instead of the condemned appointed for that day. Mostly his eyes were closed, but, says Carlyle, he opened them to see the great knife rising above him and struggled. Also, it would seem, he screamed when the executioner removed his bandages. Then the knife came down, swift and merciful. The terror was at an end. From first to last, there had been condemned and executed about 4,000 people. 12th. It witnesses to the immense vitality and the profound rightness of the flood of new ideals and intentions that the French Revolution had released into the world of practical endeavor, that it could still flow in a creative torrent after it had been caricatured and mocked in the grotesque personality and career of Robespierre. He had shown its deepest thoughts. He had displayed anticipations of its methods and conclusions. Through the green and distorting lenses of his preposterous vanity and egotism, he had smeared and blackened all its hope and promise with blood and horror, and the power of these ideas was not destroyed. They stood the extreme tests of ridiculous and horrible presentation. After his downfall, the Republic still ruled unassailable. Leaderless, for his successors were a group of crafty or commonplace men, the European Republic struggled on, and presently fell and rose again, and fell and rose and still struggles, entangled but invincible. And it's well to remind the reader here of the real dimensions of this phase of the terror which strikes so vividly upon the imagination, and which has therefore been enormously exaggerated relatively to the rest of the revolution. From 1789 to late in 1791, the French Revolution was an orderly process, and from the summer of 1794 the Republic was an orderly and victorious state. The terror was not the work of the whole country, but of the town mob, which owed its existence and its savagery to the misrule and social injustice of the ancient regime. And the explosion of the terror could have happened only through the persistent, treacherous disloyalty of the royalists, which, while it raised the extremists to frenzy, disinclined the mass of moderate republicans from any intervention. The best men were busy fighting the Austrians and royalists on the frontier. Altogether, we must remember, the total of the killed in the terror amounted to a few thousands, and among those thousands there were certainly a great number of active antagonists whom the Republic, by all the standards of that time, was entitled to kill. It included such traitors and mischief-makers as Philip, Duke of Orléans, of the Palais Royal, who had voted for the death of Louis the XVI. More lives were wasted by the British generals alone on the opening day of what's known as the Somme Offensive of July 1916 than in the whole French Revolution from start to finish. We hear so much about the martyrs of the French Terror because they were notable, well-connected people, and because there's been a sort of propaganda of their sufferings. But let's balance against them in our minds what was going on in the prisons of the world generally at that time. In Britain and America, while the terror ruled in France, far more people were slaughtered for offences, very often quite trivial offences, against property than were condemned by the Revolutionary Tribunal for treason against the state. Of course, they were very common people indeed, but in their rough way they suffered. A girl was hanged in Massachusetts in 1789 for forcibly taking the hat, shoes, and buckles of another girl she had met in the street. Again, Howard the Philanthropist, about 1773, found a number of perfectly innocent people detained in the English prisons who had been tried and acquitted but were unable to pay the jailer's fees. And these prisons were filthy places under no effective control. Torture was still in use in the Hanoverian dominions of His Britannic Majesty King George III. It had been in use in France up to the time of the National Assembly. These things mark the level of the age. It's not on record that anyone was deliberately tortured by the French revolutionaries during the Terror. Those few hundreds of French gentlefolk fell into a pit that most of them had been well content should exist for others. It was tragic, but not by the scale of universal history, a great tragedy. The common man in France was more free, better off, and happier during the Terror than he had been in 1787. The story of the Republic after the summer of 1794 becomes a tangled story of political groups aiming at everything from a radical republic to a royalist reaction, but pervaded by a general desire for some definite working arrangement, even at the price of considerable concessions. There was a series of insurrections of the Jacobins and of the royalists. There seems to have been what we should call nowadays a hooligan class in Paris, which was quite ready to turn out to fight and loot on either side. Nevertheless, the convention produced a government, the Directory of 5 members, which held France together for 5 years. The last, most threatening revolt of all, in October 1795, was suppressed with great skill and decision by a rising young general, Napoleon Bonaparte. The Directory was victorious abroad, but uncreative at home. Its members were far too anxious to stick to the sweets and glories of office to prepare a constitution that would supersede them, and far too dishonest to handle the task of financial and economic reconstruction demanded by the condition of France. We need only note 2 of their names, Carnot, who was an honest Republican, and Barras, who was conspicuously a rogue. Their reign of 5 years formed a curious interlude in this history of great changes. They took things as they found them. The propagandist zeal of the Revolution carried the French armies into Holland, Belgium, Switzerland, South Germany, and North Italy. Everywhere, kings were expelled and republics set up. But such propagandist zeal as animated the Directorate didn't prevent the looting of the treasures of the liberated peoples to relieve the financial embarrassment of the French government. Their wars became less and less the Holy War of Freedom, and more like the aggressive wars of the ancient regime. The last feature of grand monarchy that France was disposed to discard was her tradition of foreign policy, grasping, aggressive, restless, French-centered. One discovers it still as vigorous under the Directorate as if there had been no revolution. 13th. The ebb of this tide of revolution in the world, this tide which had created the great Republic of America and threatened to submerge all European monarchies, was now at hand. It is as if something had thrust up from beneath the surface of human affairs, made a gigantic effort, and for a time spent itself. It swept many obsolescent and evil things away, but many evil and unjust things remained. It solved many problems, and it left the desire for fellowship and order face to face with much vaster problems than it seemed only to have revealed. Privilege of certain types had gone, many tyrannies, much religious persecution,